Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha kakou, nisan bulbinaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Eggie DeBoer, and we appreciate your company this morning. On the show today, several people have been arrested over Vanuatu's first organised armed robbery. The US government has confirmed it's received its first application for seabed mining exploration in international waters. And burnout, it is real, more so amongst our Pacific people, so we'll look into how we can navigate that space. Well, our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, but I say me taki ma'ata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, in a highly anticipated media conference, Vanuatu's police chief has confirmed several people have been arrested over the country's first organised armed robbery. The brazen daylight heist at Port Vila's International Airport last week has been the talk of the nation, generating fevered speculation on social media. After more than a week of silence, though, Police Commissioner Carlson Bongren confirmed the details. Three men were wearing white hazmat-like suits, one armed with a rifle, held up a Western Union truck carrying foreign currency at the airport on December 29th. They assaulted the driver and made off with $600,000 in cash, fleeing in a white van. Now, Mr. Bongren says investigators made their first arrest 3 days later, and now eight people are in custody, including one woman, with charges yet to be laid. He confirmed online speculation that the alleged ringleader arrested on Santo Island is a former member of the French Foreign Legion. Now, there's also been speculation that some of the robbers are related to current and former members of Parliament, but their identities are yet to be released. In an exclusive interview with our Vanuatu reporter, Lily Rose Wellwell, Commissioner Bongren commended his officers for their response to the country's first incident of a well-planned and executed armed robbery.
Vanuatu Police Force has did an exceptional job. They moved very decisively. Our officers were very committed from day one. Since the incident occurred, it took them 3 days at least to collect data, information, the intelligence and everything. Within a span of 3 days, after 3 days we start arresting suspects. And as now we've managed to arrest eight suspects. Seven of those suspects are currently in correctional service facility, while one is still in police custody. We have managed to retrieve at least 90% of the 600,000 Australian dollars that was stolen, in cash that was stolen, and we have also confiscated a firearm that was involved in the robbery and also the vehicle that was involved in the incident.
So there are seven that are already been remanded and there's one out in police custody. Why is that?
The one is in police custody is basically because he had a boil on a part of his, you know, body, so he needs to have undergone proper medical checks and other treatment before we better deal with him. He's currently at the National Hospital. The Vanuatu Police Force are on security 24/7. As soon as his boil is recovered, he recovered from that, then the police will continue to investigate and, you know, get his statements and everything. And then we'll transfer him down to the correctional facility awaiting a court date for them to appear before the courts.
Are there any reasons behind the alleged robbery? Was that being given to the police? And is the police aware of the reason behind the robbery?
The actual reason behind the robbery is not yet cleared. Our investigators will, go further into their investigations and questioning, and that will become more clear at some later stage.
Okay. How was the police made aware of the suspects and how they were able to manage to capture them?
We actually got, as you know, the suspects were wearing uniforms that, you know, isolate them and, does not disclose them to anybody. They were covered, they come in uniforms that they were wearing falaclavas and nobody recognized them. So what the police did was, you know, get information from few leads that they have in the community. We cannot reveal those leads. And it was those little tips ops that police had from the communities that actually led them into, you know, following up and arresting those 8 suspects.
And that's Police Commissioner Garson Bongram there. Now, the police copped some criticism from online commentators over the pace of their investigation. And the government was also criticised for allowing the normally unarmed police to carry guns as they hunted for their robbers. The Internal Security Minister, Andrew Nuppart, says that decision has been vindicated, as has the conduct of police.
Whenever we as a country face such issues, we must stand together, work with the law enforcement officers and support them in their work, because this is not an easy task for our officers. And so whatever the comments that they made concerning the operations that was being carried out by the Vanuatu Police Force, I think they were trying to downplay the idea of why the government had to use the arms during the operation. Based on the initial complaint that was filed within the Vanuatu Police Force, there was information that it was an armed robbery. And therefore, according to the security situation, the complaint and the analysis that came from the Vanuatu Police Force, it was important for the officers to be armed, for them to be involved in such operations. It's not a new thing. It has always happened in the past where whenever there is a situation in the country that warrants the use of arms, there is in the law powers that allow the Minister of Internal Affairs to authorize the use of arms. And it was necessary at that time, even though there were rumors spreading around that it was not an armed robbery and they were trying to downplay that information. But in the end, the investigation confirmed that it was an armed robbery. There was an arm that was confiscated by the investigation team and our officers, so it was the right decision.
And that is Vanuatu's Internal Security Minister, Andrew Nuppart, speaking to reporter Lily Rose Walwell. Now, a shooting outside a church building in the US city of Salt Lake City has resulted in 2 deaths and 6 injuries, all of whom believed to be members of the Tongan diaspora. The victims have been named as 2 men, Sione Vatuvei and Vaia Turikihihifo. No arrests have been made. Now, Salt Lake Place spokesperson Chief Brian Redd said in a media update the shooting grew out of a dispute between funeral attendees.
There was a dispute last night between individuals who are known to each other who happened to be attending a funeral service, a memorial service. We do not believe at this time there is a threat to the general public.
Now, the incident occurred in the parking lot of a meeting house of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where dozens of people were attending a funeral. Utah police believe there was an exchange of gunfire and that police have been stationed at the hospital to monitor the injured.
There are people involved in this incident who have been less than cooperative, and we're still working to identify all who were involved in the incident and their roles in the matter. Our focus now is bringing all those involved to justice.
And that was Salt Lake Place spokesperson Chief Brian Redd. Give you the latest media update on a fatal shooting in Utah that has left 2 Tongan Americans dead. Now, the US government has confirmed it has received its first application for seabed mining exploration in international waters. The metals company submitted the application under US law alongside 2 other applications for exploration licenses. The Trump administration has made seabed mining a priority, where in April an executive order was signed calling for permits in both US and international waters. Laurie Osmundson, an international environmental lawyer, who specialises in ocean law, told Lucy Cooper the applications once again raises questions about the legality of mining in international waters.
These applications that just been published at the end of December as being received by NOAA, these are for international waters. These are pertaining to areas of the Clarion-Clipperton Zone in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, roughly halfway between Mexico and Hawaii. But they are in international waters, not under the jurisdiction of the United States or any other country. So basically, in a nutshell, TMC is applying to proceed with deep sea bed mining activities in the same area of the Pacific for which it currently holds exploration rights under the ISA.
Does it shed light on any extra information about the metals company's intentions with seabed mining exploration?
Overall, I would say no. These applications largely reiterate a lot of information that TMC has previously disclosed elsewhere, various fora. Such as investor updates and other pronouncements it's made.
Do you have any concerns with what you've read in this application?
Yes. I mean the concerns that I and many other experts who've looked at deep sea mining for quite a while sort of coalesce around the environmental aspects and many assumptions that are made about impacts or the lack thereof reflected in these applications that don't correspond to the findings of the scientific community at large.
In August last year, the metals company publicly announced that it expects to commence commercial production in the fourth quarter of 2027 if they do receive a commercial permit. Now that it is confirmed that the US government is assessing the application, is this target achievable?
I would say not, in my opinion, and one of the reasons for that timescale being incredibly optimistic is that as of today, as of when we're speaking, the commercial recovery application is not officially being processed. And there's a legal reason for that. The two applications that were released for public notice and comment on December 23rd, 2025, are for the exploration licenses only for two areas in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. They are not regarding TMC's application for a commercial recovery permit. And the reason why is that under the U.S. statute, NOAA cannot consider a commercial recovery permit application from an applicant that does not currently hold an exploration license from that agency, from NOAA. TMC does not have that. If TMC were to get an exploration license approved from NOAA, then it could proceed with its commercial recovery permit application, but then that goes on its own separate process under the regulations, which under the procedures in the regulations takes well over a year to run its course.
Last year, when the US President Donald Trump signed an executive order to accelerate the development of seabed mining resources, there was a lot of uncertainty about whether this sidesteps the International Seabed Authority or not, which that authority under a 1994 international agreement known as the Law of the Sea does regulate mineral extraction from the seafloor. The US hasn't ratified the Law of the Sea, but do you believe its permit process does sidestep the authority?
Yeah, there's a broad consensus, I think, among international legal experts that it does. This issue has never come to a head before, but it certainly is coming to a head now. And I think the U.S. administration argument is, as you alluded to, the fact that while the United States has never ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty, however, the law on the books in the United States under which TMC is now applying for permission from NOAA directly sort of refers to the Law of the Sea Treaty, and it was sort of passed at a time that preceded the Law of the Sea Treaty and it speaks in terms of this applying as an interim measure until the Law of the Sea Treaty came into force, which, of course, it has. So in the intervening decades, and it's been actually 45 years now since this U.S. law was enacted, you know, in that period of time, there's been this international regime that has developed under the Law of the Sea Convention and the ISA to regulate deep seabed activities. And so there's an international body of law that has developed. The U.S. is not recognizing that. There's definitely a clash on the horizon there.
If the U.S. government approves the metals company's application for seabed mining exploration in international waters, how will we see this carry out?
Well, that's anybody's guess, and it's certainly causing quite a bit of concern because you basically have two conflicting authorities, two conflicting regimes, the ISA and the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is set up to have exclusive oversight of deep seabed resources for the benefit of humanity. And so you've got basically the United States against the rest of the world in terms of management and benefits to be had from deep seabed minerals. So that's you know, the essence of a conflict that could arise.
Can the U.S. government mine in international waters or only in its own EEZ and that of its territories?
It's difficult to really be clear on that because certainly all of the 169 countries that have ratified the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea say it would say absolutely that the United States does not have the unilateral right to mine a deep seabed in international waters. And even under the U.S. statute, Deep Sea Hard Minerals Resources Act that I alluded to previously, even under that statute, there's a provision in that law that says the United States does not assert sovereignty, exclusive rights, or jurisdiction over or ownership of any areas or resources of the deep seabed. That's baked into that statute. So that has everyone sort of scratching their heads as to why the current U.S. administration seems to believe that it does have the right to mine the seabed in international waters.
And that is Laurie Osmundson, international environmental lawyer who specialises in ocean law, speaking with Lucy Cooper.
Hold the front page!
Mano e tau mai bongbongini, it is good to join, to have you join us here on Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBol, and in the studio with me this morning is our producer, Whenau Whanua. Whewehake.
Sopi, Aggie, I'm fine, thank you.
It's the last day of the week. You happy?
Yes, it is. It's boiling hot here in Melbourne.
We 44. Are. That's it. It's going to reach 44 degrees. And yeah, thank goodness for aircon right now. But there is some hot news, of course, happening around the region. This one, it's a bit of an unfortunate one. I believe in the Solomon Islands, a woman who embezzled more than 1.3 million Solomon Island dollars while serving as a teacher has been handed a 4-year jail term. You have to tell us what's happened here.
Yes, 1.3 million Solomon Islands dollars, that's the equivalent of over 240 million Australian.
Ooh.
The teacher has been sentenced to 4 years imprisonment by the Honiara Magistrates Court. In her sentencing remarks, the magistrate described her conduct as an extremely high level of dishonesty, which was carried out deliberately over a period of 7 months. And during that period, she went on what she called a shopping spree.
Wow. Okay, then. She probably would have had a nice new bag. Unfortunately, that's $240 million Australian.
Yes.
That's a lot of money.
It is.
Very, very unfortunate. Okay, well, we head to Vanuatu, where we're hearing reports that Port Vila CBD roads are to be upgraded by a Chinese grant. That sounds like good news.
Yes, Vanuatu Daily Post reports the government will give more than receive a more than 200 million Australian dollar grant to upgrade roads in the Port Vila Central Business District. Many of these roads still being restored because of that earthquake last year. The scope of the work includes upgrading and renovating nearly 20 roads in the downtown area. Prime Minister Napat said the grant assistance will help enhance Port Vila's image for visitors, and he reaffirmed Vanuatu's commitment to the One China principle and expressed gratitude for China's ongoing assistance to Vanuatu.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's nice to have a new image for visitors, but I think it's just more brings back a little bit of normality, right?
Yes.
For the country and bring back some sort of better economic, stableness to the country. So good to hear, good to hear. We're also hearing, though, reports that Samoa is set to establish an embassy to Israel and Jerusalem. This is interesting.
Yes, Samoa Observer reports that the Prime Minister, Lauli Leiter-Smit, announced on Tuesday at a special prayer service that he's instructed the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to prepare for the establishment of a Samoan embassy in Jerusalem. It would be only one of a handful of there's only a handful of embassies in Jerusalem. Lauli was speaking at this prayer service, which is held specifically for Israel on Tuesday. Samoa would be just the third Pacific Island country to have an embassy in Israel besides Fiji and Papua New Guinea. He said he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Fiji, who established a new embassy just last September.
Interesting, interesting. This obviously is in line with how he even is the proposal of banning, you know, other non-Christian
yes, that's
religions,
correct.
Right? So is that...
There was a he indicated, I believe it was last week, that they would, the government should look into banning non-Christian religions in Samoa.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will still be following up that story. But as always, Finau, thank you very much for coming through and bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politok dives straight into the tough questions, like who is actually stepping in to save people from sorcery accusation violence in Papua New Guinea?
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group there, and then they accused her, like, you must be the sorceress.
On Politok, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
To all our ABC Radio Australia listeners, welcome to 2026.
New year, new schedule, and the sounds of the Pacific right where you want them.
Yes, your favorite shows are now playing at times that suit your day, whether you're waking up, winding down, or anywhere in between.
The same trusted voices, great music, sport, news, and stories from across the Pacific, now easier to catch than ever.
Tune in, stay connected, and make ABC Radio Australia part of your 2026.
ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, a family-owned company in Tonga has become the first in the country to achieve a certification, allowing it to export guava to new commercial markets. Ariana Guava Trading has successfully completed the globally recognised hazard analysis and critical control point audit and certification for their facility. As one of the largest guava exporters in Tonga, it's been exporting to the US for a decade. Minevia works for her family's business as the finance and administration officer and told Lucy Cooper they recently planted an extra 10,000 plants to meet surging demand.
The current demand for cover is extremely high globally because we are facing a cover shortage at the moment, a global cover shortage, and it's happening here in the island, but the demand is extremely high, and also the cover prices are also high. Currently, we supply about 1,200 to 1,400 kilo of cover to in 2 months to one of our current markets, and one of our markets we supply 500 to 600 kilos a month. Just yesterday, we have received a message from one of our current customers to increase the volume of demand. So we have talked and discussed about how the issues are happening here at the moment with the current cover shortage. And of course, the cover prices should be going up. And I think this is a good time for cover growers, and especially for us, these current customers, they increase their volume, and also the cover prices are extremely high. And I think that would be a good opportunity for us cover growers and for Ariana cover trading, especially at this time of shortage. There are lots of buyers have reached out to us to buy cover, but with the current shortage, we have to limit the buyers and just focus on our current commercial market, so we can be able to keep us supplying them with our cover product.
And what do you think has really driven that high surge in demand?
Here in Tonga, traditionally the cover is one of the key cultural useful cultural ceremony here in Tonga, and also cover is mostly used by men for social gathering. It happens also in US markets, because currently we supplying to Cover Pass, and one of the beverage company in the US, and Cover product is most popular drink in the US market. But not only that, but it is a safe product for human consumption, like for drinking and for social gathering. And I think and I believe that this is how it drives the demand to increase.
The latest exciting part for the business is recent certification that you've gone through. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Big milestone we have recently achieved as HACCP certified. It was an enjoyable moment and proud moment for Ariana Cover Trading and the team to be the first cover exporter to be HACCP certified. And I think it's not only for Ariana Cover Trading, but it's also a proud milestone for the island of Ewa as a whole and the cover growers who have supplied the Ariana cover export. With the HACCP certification process, it wasn't an easy journey, but at the end, it was a very rewarding. The HACCP certification process was first started on November 2023 and completed on November 2025.
What does this now allow you to do on top of what you've already been doing in terms of cava exports?
This would provide opportunities for us to expand to more commercial markets like pharmaceutical markets. I think with this certification, it also encourages not just us, but for other cava growers and exporters to keep up with the food safety standard of how to process the cava for export.
And that there is Mele Vea of Tonga's Ariana Cava Trading speaking with Lucy Cooper. Now, the Solomon Islands will not be taking part in the upcoming Miss Pacific Islands pageant for 2026. It's a decision that has sparked debate across the region, but with allegations of fraudulent activities, including tampering with votes that led to a stop notice to detain the judges, preventing them from leaving Honiara at last year's event. So, what would this withdrawal mean from this year's competition? The best person to answer that is Pageant Director of the Miss Solomon Islands Pageant and Chief Executive Officer of Solomon Host Event, Joyce Gonofilia. With that, I say, hello and get that, Joyce. Happy New Year's and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Happy New Year's. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for joining us. I do know that you are out back at, you know, in your village. We are having a bit of technical difficulty, but we are going to try our best this morning. So I appreciate you joining us. Firstly, Joyce, can you maybe just take us back a little bit to last year's competition? Because we understand allegations of judge fraud, the tampering of the votes. Like, how much did this affect you and even affect the pageant community?
Okay, so yes, it does have an impact on our program because we were not able to do the local Miss Solomon Island pageant. Consequently, we are not able to be represented at the Miss Pacific Island pageant in Fiji this year. These allegations were denied, of course, but it went through a period where we even ended up with the police investigations we haven't been able to get through with a criminal investigation to the end, but it does flood our event and also our ability to continue with the pageant, like I said, because of all this drama and the fact that our government spent so much in the Miss Pacific Island pageant 2025. It was seen as being, you know, disrespectful, and it brought disrepute to our organization and the event as a whole. Mm. So we were instructed by the Minister of Home Affairs not to join Miss Pacific Island pageant, and we'll see where we go from there. Yeah.
And Joyce, have you been okay with that decision, though? Because obviously it wasn't just a decision that you made yourself. That was at the direction of Ministry of Home Affairs.
No. Yeah, that's right. It wasn't my own decision. We had to respect the government because they were the main sponsors. And, of course, there were some evidences provided about what happened. And I even brought it up to the board, as I was the chair lady, but it wasn't carried through. So I also agreed to go with what our government instructed, because I believe that we should sort this out and really find out the truth about what happened. Yeah.
And so, of course, there's an ongoing police investigation. Is that correct? What is the latest around that?
I am not really sure about the ongoing investigations, because I've had conflicting information from the authorities. Apparently there was a protest note from the Samoan government to our government about the way the judge was treated, being stopped at the airport. So I think there was a halt to the investigations. But as far as we are concerned, as the organizing body, we would really like to know, you know, we would really like to see the end results of the investigations, because it does have a lot of implications on, you know, on everything, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm really hoping that at some stage they will eventually put this to a closure, but otherwise, no, I haven't heard of any ongoing investigations.
Okay. Joyce, are you concerned, though, that this decision may affect, you know, regional cultural connections at all?
Well, Yes, I am concerned that as a consistent member of MPIP, we have not been able to attend for this reason, and that it might have some kind of effect on how the other members see us. But I would rather stand for the truth. I mean, I really want to know the truth. I want to know what really happened because we have some evidence provided. Yeah, but I think to a certain level, I don't think it's that really for on a political level. I think our government have talked to the Samoan government. On our level as pageant organizers, we really hope that this does not bring negative perceptions on what the pageants stand for. And we've already had concerns raised on the public, social media about, biasness and colorism and all these issues.
Yes.
And for me, I'd rather deal with these issues and make sure that our future.
Well, it looks like we've had Joyce cut out there. If I can just maybe, I'll quickly try and ask this last question before we try and have, if you drop out again. I just want to ask, what would you like to happen, though, for maybe possibly Solomon Islands to consider returning to Miss Pacific Island stage?
I would really like, I sincerely would really like to have this issue investigated. That's my real concern. I would like to see that what happened on the night and all the allegations are brought to to justice, because we need to know exactly what happened, why and why it happened. We do not dispute the Miss Samoa's victory. No, we are talking about the processes. The procedures that were used, the protocols that were breached, and we need to do the right thing, and so that's why I'm insisting that we carry it to the end and probably get it to the end. But then, I guess with politics and other diplomatic ties with the Samoan government, it might not happen. But we're trying to protect the integrity of our pageants, and also with the advice from our minister, we have decided to let go of this year, and probably if things are all sorted out and if we have the right conversations going on, and then we can come back next year, or probably there's already talk of Miss Melanesian pageant being organized. So yeah, but I would love that we thought this out, and we are Pacific, we are family, we want to be part of a Island pageant.
Absolutely. Yes. Look, Joyce, thank you so much for holding on and being able to speak to us this morning about, of course, Miss Pacific Islands and also the Miss Solomon Islands pageant itself and the future of it. So, look, let's hope for some good days ahead. But again, we want to say thank you so much for joining us this morning on the show.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much for reaching out to us.
No worries.
Absolutely.
That is Pageant Director of the Miss Solomon Islands Pageant and Chief Executive Officer of Solomon Host Event, Joyce Gonofilia.
Now, join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
DJ Noise. Am I doing that right?
Can I hear your best? Another one. Give us a DJ Khaled.
All right.
DJ Khaled!
Another one.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
But Vitaite Lily Lover for joining us here on Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. Well, a recent study has highlighted growing levels of burnout amongst Pacific people due to the weight of cultural and family obligations. Now, the burnout has led to a rise in mental health issues. So how does one navigate a healthy boundary when it comes to cultural expectations? On the line with us this morning is Asitoa Sambilisi, PhD student from the University of Auckland, to discuss this more. With that, I say whakalofalaia to Sam and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Whakalofalaia to Aggie. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Absolutely. Appreciate you coming on the show. Very interesting study that's been done. I'm wondering what prompted you to do such a study and why now?
I did some master's studies about 5 years ago. Spoke to Pacific University students who I knew were very busy in their families and communities. And they all found it very tricky to juggle study and these responsibilities. All enjoyed serving, understood the importance of generosity, duty, love, and so forth. They all advocated for self-care and said boundaries are important. Then when pushed to ask, what does that look like? Everyone was pretty stumped. I guess we understand the principle of self-care, looking after yourself, but it gets very tricky, I guess, in our collective type communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think I may come from the old school era where it's just like, you know, brush it off and carry on. But I'm sure that's not the case, is it?
Oh, 100%. Resilience is both expected and revered in our communities. And we do need to push through, be tough and carry on. In our case here in New Zealand, I'm not sure about Australia, but the New Zealand sort of mantra too is she'll be right, get on with it. And so when we have these sort of influences, it sort of pushes us to be tough, but also can mask sort of some of the effects around our physical, mental well-being.
Sam, now, were there specific types of, like, you know, cultural obligations that contributed to stress and burnout?
Again, people understand the importance of duty, love, service, and so forth. But I guess people found it very tricky to pause, to refill. And when they can't do that or don't do that, then it can compromise their health and well-being, and it's right across the board from in the family home, and workplaces, and church, and so forth. I guess underpinning that is people feel guilty when they feel like they're letting others down, and so it's sort of this a toing and froing from sort of trying to do their best for others, and sometimes that can come at a cost to their own personal health and well-being.
Yeah. And when you were doing the study, did you find sort of differences maybe amongst the age groups that you interviewed and in their responses?
Yeah, we did. And to be expected, we could see some generational differences. And because our current study looks at Pacific people between ages 18 to 65, so a huge age gap. And what we can see is that more of an appreciation in younger people around burnout, mental health. I guess for older people, sometimes these things aren't real, or 20, 30 years ago, they definitely weren't. And so there is a mantra and a lifestyle around just getting on with it. And I've heard from plenty of people across our community saying that, yeah, burnout's not real. It wasn't real for our parents. We just need to get on with it.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part, that it is real. For many of us, I think we maybe not had a name for it before, I'm thinking, whereas now, because we have studies like this, another sort of, you know, not scenario, but saying is, you know, is it a case of just, hey, stop giving money to the family events and you'll be better off?
Yeah, like I guess that's one simplified solution to these things. Overarching that, what we see is that boundaries are important. Personal boundaries, finding ways to give, pause, give, refill, replenish. But in and amongst that is obviously things such as love, duty, feeling guilty, feeling like we're being selfish. And so it makes it incredibly difficult to sort of enact these sort of perhaps simple solutions. Give less, look after yourself, you should be good.
Can I ask then just your definition then of burnout? What does that actually look like?
The burnout we've used is an amended version of the WHO burnout definition, which says you're physically, mentally exhausted. You're feeling a little bit over it in terms of what your responsibilities are. You're feeling a bit disconnected to them. And then I guess your confidence or your ability to perform at the level that you've been able to do before, and maybe at a different season you've been able to juggle 10 things. In this current instance, perhaps you're struggling to juggle the 5. And so a combination of all of these things together, feeling a bit over it, stretched, physically you're done or spent, and you just can't do the things you've been able to do before. That's what we've used as burnout, and it sort of reconciles with lots of people in our communities. But as you've said, Aggie, perhaps we haven't had a name for it before. Mm. And also we have a community that relies on us. We have families that rely on us. So we might feel like we're over it. We might feel like we're physically or mentally stretched. But if there's no one else to do the work, or if that's our calling, then we get up and we go again.
Mm, not going to lie, that sort of sounds like me. My goodness. How does this kind of burnout, though, differ from what we usually sort of understand as burnout? Is there any difference as to how, you know, our Pacific people carry this burnout?
I guess we're just tough and resilient people. And so burnout or not, and I guess my conversations with lots of people is life goes on. We carry on. Where we're at with the study right now is we don't fully know what the, I guess, long-term impacts look like. And so what we can sort of suggest is that obviously if you're stretching yourself one way, you don't take the time to refill in other parts of your life, then you can sort of feel stress, feeling run down and all these things. Mm. What we don't know is obviously over the lifespan, what does that look like when we're perhaps living 2 or 3 lives in the space of one, in terms of our responsibilities and the loads that we carry. A Ministry of Pacific Peoples study in 2019 found that in New Zealand, Pacific people volunteer or serve or do non-paid hours of work more than any other ethnic community in New Zealand, which is not a surprise. We live very busy lives. And lots of these things, responsibilities, are the right thing to do. They give us joy. They bring a sense of pride in our churches, families, communities. All great things.
Yeah.
I guess sometimes the things we don't talk about, or we talk about grumbling in our car or when we're at home just with our immediate family, sometimes the cost to these things, and not just the financial cost, but the toll, physical, mental toll to all of these things. And in some instances, for parts of our community, it's often, if it's for the right cause, then it's worth it.
Yeah,
it is what it is. If we sacrifice these things, then at the sum, the bigger outcome, the bigger cause, if it was worth it, it was worth it. And we'll carry the cost. What we don't know is obviously from a health and well-being perspective is that what does that look like in terms of the sacrifice and the toll that's taken on your health and well-being over the lifespan.
Mm. Goodness, such an important dilemma to have. Sam, as we wrap up, I want to, there's two parts to this question, and if you don't mind answering it, it's more the what role can our family or communities play, you know, in reducing burnout while probably still upholding those cultural values. Yeah. And at the same time, what would your message be to someone who probably is listening right now, nodding their head yes to all that you've described around burnout? Yeah, what would be the message to someone who's probably feeling a little bit overwhelmed right now?
Thank you, Aggie. For the first question, I totally agree with you. It's a family's community's approach to burnout. In our homes, in our workplaces, well, in our groups of friends, we need to talk about what does well-being look like, what's important to us, how do we perhaps lift the guilt and the shame associated with looking after yourself and prioritizing your well-being. Obviously, 2026, we had the new year, so this is often the perfect time to sort of assess what worked well in 2025, what can we carry into 2026, and what do we need to do a little bit differently. And it's not necessarily throwing it all out, because it's also retaining these values about generosity, love, but finding ways that we can do it in a sustainable way. Then the second part is obviously if you're feeling, I guess, a bit spent, feeling a little bit over it, based on just life. Life is busy and stressful. Stress is good. Stress brings some of the goodness out of us in terms of resilience, fight, and so forth. But I think it's really important to have healthy discussions with your loved ones, get your spouse, your children, your best friends in the chat group, these sort of things. And I guess rifting off some of the sort of mental health conversations, it's okay to not be okay. And so we need to encourage people that sometimes we're just not on. We're not robots. We need to refill, we need to pause. And I think my encouragement back to people is that, yes, it's important to serve well, but also it's important to serve well and live well. And we shouldn't feel guilty about that. And most of our loved ones would want you to live well as well. Live well, live long. And so that's my encouragement, is to serve well in the best way that you can, but also find a way in which you can serve well and live well.
Yeah, those are some great words to really start off for the year 2026. I definitely think this is important, Talanoa. But Sam, look, that's all the time we have for this morning, but really appreciate you sharing with us. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. No worries.
That is Asito Sam Bilisi, PhD student from the University of Auckland, speaking to media on the study of burnout amongst Pacific people. That brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to look back at our main story. Several people being arrested over Major Vanuatu's armed robbery.
And as now, we've managed to arrest 8 suspects. 7 of those suspects are currently in correctional service facility. We have managed to retrieve at least 90% of the $600,000 Australian dollars that was stolen.
Well, that's us for this week. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nija Daily, hosted by Sosifua Morley. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.